We will talk about the cost of living during this edition of On Your Money. And financial planner Kevin McKinley will have information and advice on making ends meet and wise investments. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some new figures that may be useful for those of you planning on moving to or from Wisconsin, a stress test for your investments, and some tips on staying safe in the water this summer. Plus, answers to your personal finance questions. What money matters are on your mind today? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, is it true, Kevin, that Wisconsin residents generally spend less than those that are in most other states?
That's for better or for worse. Some recent figures offer some perspective to those of us who live here and are always complaining about the high cost of living. And it also offers some information for those who might be moving for the money, whether that is to our great state or they're thinking about taking a higher paying job elsewhere.
So what are the numbers?
According to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, this is from 2012, and these figures are per capita, per person. So if you have a family of four, multiply these numbers by four for what you might spend in the state of Wisconsin. And the categories are housing and utilities. That's $500 per month per person. We rank 27th in the country in that. First is the most, and 51st is the last. 51st, of course, is for the District of Columbia. In healthcare, we spend more than the average per capita state numbers, $550 per month per person. That's 13th. And everything else figures into a category of other, and that's $1,500 per month. And we're 29th in the country in that. And overall, we spend per capita about $2,900 per month. And that puts us smack dab in the middle, 26th overall. The highest overall states and areas were D.C. Spent $5,000 per month per capita on these items compared to our $2,900. And the lowest overall was Mississippi with $2,600 compared to our $2,900.
Well, so how might these figures be useful to people who might be thinking about moving?
Compare your income and your spending to the cost of living in that new location, and especially for new graduates who have just walked off a stage with a diploma in hand from some institution of higher learning, and hopefully you're getting some job offers and you've got your choice of positions around the country. And when you're thinking about what you're going to get paid in those job offers, know this. If you are going to get a nice $36,000 starting salary in, let's say, Green Bay, Wisconsin, if you're comparing that to a job in Manhattan, you would need $83,000 to have the same lifestyle that $36,000 buys you in Green Bay. And plus, because the federal income tax code is progressive, and it applies to everybody in every state. It doesn't distinguish from one state's cost of living to another. A greater portion of your income in the higher cost of living states, if you're making more money, will go towards your income taxes. And then you have to figure other things like your commute. If you're planning on having kids or you have kids, you have to look at the schools. A lot of us in Wisconsin take it for granted that we can send our kids to good public schools. They're usually very convenient, and they're right around the block, and even private schools are relatively inexpensive, but people in other metropolitan areas especially do not have that luxury. And I've talked with several middle-income families over the years who they send their kids to private schools that cost $20,000 a year, and it's not because, you know, they want some so-called advantage. It's because they're concerned about the kids' safety. The same thing goes for retirees, people who by definition can live almost anywhere they want. The Social Security checks are the same, no matter if you live in Wisconsin or Arkansas or California. Therefore, if you find a lower cost place to live, those Social Security checks and your other distributions from your retirement accounts will go a lot further. So the cost of living should definitely be a consideration in anything you take into account for when you're trying to decide where you're going to live.
Yeah, way back when, Kevin, when I was a Cub reporter, I saw a job opportunity in San Francisco, and the salary to me was, you know, beyond the pale. It was just out of this world high as far as I was concerned. But then I looked into the cost of living in San Francisco, and I would have been living on the streets.
Yeah, and if you are going to, especially if you're renting someplace, rents are extraordinarily high across the country right now, and it's in most places it's difficult for a person working full-time, a single person working full-time at minimum wage, to afford a one-bedroom apartment in that particular area. San Francisco is another place like Manhattan. As a matter of fact, if you are renting, you're probably going to pay even more to live in San Francisco than you are going to, than if you're going to live in Manhattan.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services that we discuss are suitable for any particular investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, our lines are open for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag. And before we get to this week's question, you had a follow-up, Kevin, to a listener who called us last week. What did you want to follow up on?
She had asked, she was thinking about in saving money for college for her kids. And she had asked why an advisor was suggesting the Tomorrow Scholar plan, which is Wisconsin's 529 plan, versus the EdVest plan, which is also Wisconsin's 529 college savings plan, when saving for college through Wisconsin. And I had my inklings when she asked this question, but I didn't want to say for sure until I could research this. I'm a fee-only advisor, and so I don't deal with the Tomorrow Scholar product because it's a commission-based investment. And I didn't want to say that on the air until I knew for sure, and I still don't know what the motivations were. She said the advisor said, well, they have more investment offerings than the EdVest one. And that could be true. They might even be better. But the fact that she was going to be paying a commission for this Tomorrow Scholar versus the EdVest program, which doesn't charge any commission, he should have disclosed that to her and said, if you don't want me to help you with this, you can go to the EdVest and do it yourself, or I'll do it, help you for it, but I won't charge you for it. But instead, it sounds like that he wanted to earn commission, obviously, for getting paid to help her. But he should have disclosed that to her as the difference for it as well. So if you're looking at those different plans out there, the Tomorrow Scholar is generally offered through advisors, and they usually get paid commission to offer it. The EdVest is often offered through fee-based advisors, or you can do it on your own.
Yeah, I remember that, and I remember you telling her your preference for EdVest, but good to know. A listener named Larry emails. He says he wants to cash in his IRA to help his daughter buy a house. Boy, nice dad. But he's concerned that the withdrawals might be taxed at a higher rate than if he were just to take the money out over time. So what advice do you have for Larry?
Well, Larry's right. And depending on the amount, he might pay an extra 10 to 20% in taxes over what he would take if he were just to take it normally, meaning if he just took, let's say, $100,000 out right now and he was going to use that money to help his daughter buy a house or anything else. He would probably pay $10,000 to $20,000 more in taxes than he otherwise would if he were just to pay it out. And he may lose some tax breaks. He may start to pay higher Medicare premiums because if he's retired and on Medicare, that also is an income-based program. And the higher your income is, generally, the more you pay on the premiums. Now, it's just a one-time situation, so it wouldn't affect him in the future because he's not going to be making these big withdrawals. But yes, he's exactly right. It could be a huge tax bill if he pulls this big lump sum out.
Is there a better way for him to help his daughter?
Probably the easiest way to do it would be to split the withdrawals, figure out what he needs and take half of it out right now, and then take the other half out on January 2nd of 2016. And then it'll at least be split between two income tax years, and hopefully by doing that, he'll be able to mitigate the actual tax rate. And because, again, we're in a progressive federal income tax system, the more your income is, the higher your tax rate generally will be. So if he can even that out between two tax years, hopefully he'll save a lot in taxes, and then again, not forego some of those tax breaks he might otherwise lose.
Is there any way to do it faster, though?
Yeah, he might just want to see if he can borrow the money to buy the house for her and buy it himself out of other savings, use a home equity loan or a home equity line of credit, or even get a new mortgage on the house and then or co-sign for the loan for the daughter if she can't get it on her own without his financial help for it. And then as he pulls the money out over time from the IRA, he can hopefully make the mortgage payments on it as well.
What about the interest?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of interest on that, but the net interest cost, meaning let's say if he leaves that money in his IRA versus what the cost of the interest is. Now, depending on the investment that's within the IRA, that could be a volatile return. He could lose money on it. And if it's safe, he's not going to make much, maybe 1% to 2% on it. But even then, the net interest cost will probably be about 2% per year. And if once he's over 70 and a half, he's going to take required minimum distributions from that retirement account anyway. So he could just use the RMDs to actually make most of the mortgage payments on it. And this also helps them keep their options open because he can always cash it out in the future and pay off the mortgage if he feels like it, or give the money to his daughter to pay off the mortgage if she has one herself.
Well, speaking of questions, you and I are both off next week, but we're turning with a special all questions answered show 2 weeks from today, right, Kevin?
Yeah, where are we going again? You were
going to
book
I'm going
the flights
to Alaska, and you're
oh gosh,
going,
no, I'm not going to Alaska. yeah, we're going to. We've been getting a ton of questions in. Again, the phone lines are filled up right now. We're getting lots of emails in, and so we're going to devote an entire show to trying to clean out the email bag and answer all of your questions as well. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can contact me directly by sending an email to kevin@onyourmoney.com, and you can also try to call during the show. But again, we usually get a lot of callers, and so we can't guarantee we'll get to your call if you don't send in an email.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. Our lines are full now, but should one free up, 1-800-642-1234. Judy in Conover is with us. Hi, Judy.
Hello, Kevin. Hello, Joy.
Hello, Judy.
Okay, I love your show, Joy, and I love every Tuesday and Sunday. Sometimes my husband and I listen twice a week together.
Excellent.
Anyway, you give great advice across the board, and one thing that I always like to hear when you are validating something we've done, and one thing we've done since the 80s is buy I-bonds. And we're retired now, and as of May 1st, there is a deflationary rate on the I-bonds, and the current yield, because the original fixed rate was low enough, the current yield is now migrating to zero for the next 6 months. What is your comment on this? I mean, not so much what should we do or what should anyone do, but has this happened in historical times, or I'm just flabbergasted that they can give 0% return on a savings bond. Seems crazy.
It is crazy, and these are very weird times we're living in right now. Judy, let's back up. Series I savings bonds are one of my favorite safe places to put money. The interest rate they pay, as Judy alluded to, they have a fixed component, and then there's another component that's tied to the inflation rate. And that interest rate changes every 6 months, every May 1st and November 1st. And because inflation is relatively low, according to the government figures anyway, the interest rate now on those bonds is 0%. And that will stay true until the 1st of November. And unless inflation bumps up or interest rates rise, it won't go up as well. I don't think you should pull those out, and a couple of reasons, one of which is if you've been deferring the taxes on it, you're going to pay taxes on whatever interest you have when you pull them out. And if you don't need the money, it's not a good idea to pay the taxes if you don't have to. The second thing is that if you you've had that bond more than 12 months, there's a three-month penalty for early withdrawal unless you've had it for more than 5 years. And it's tough to get the money out within the first 12 months. I'm not necessarily sure I would run charging into those bonds, but because you can only put $10,000 per person per year into savings bonds, you might just want to maybe not buy them, but don't take them out because it's hard to get the money back in, especially big lump sums. And eventually, inflation may rise and interest rates will rise, and then those Series I savings bonds will become more attractive. They're kind of an anomaly, though, because sometimes they seem to lag interest rates themselves and what they pay out by about 6 to 12 months. And so when rates seem to be going up, these things pay zero. And then when rates are down or flat, these things become a little bit more attractive. So unless you need the money for something else or you find a really phenomenal CD someplace, I would leave them in there for the time being.
Thank you for the call, Judy. Coming up, we will take many more of your personal finance questions, and Kevin will explain why it might be time to run a stress test on our investments. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Conn Mequon is with us. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. I have a question for your guest. Currently, I'm in grad school, and I had a couple of about $4,000 left off from one of my subsidized loans, and I have the exact same amount in credit card debt that's been hanging over my head for quite a while now. And I was wondering what impact that would have, if that would be a smart call to actually just transfer that and pay off debt, and what that would also help or, you know, destroy my credit score. I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah, do you know the interest rate, Con, on the credit card debt?
It's about 6.9.
Okay.
Actually, about 6%. It's kind of high, I think.
For credit card debt?
That's not too bad.
Oh,
no,
sorry?
That's the interest on the credit card debt is around 6%.
Actually, no. I take that back. That's on another credit card. I think it's pushing the teens. I don't know specifically, but it's pushing the teens. Yeah.
Okay, that's better. So you're saying you've got some cash from a student loan proceeds. You borrowed the student loans,
yeah,
but you don't technically need the money right now. Might you need it for school in the future?
Probably not.
Okay. I would rather have you, especially at that interest rate, that's not a great interest rate, but it's not terrible. The median interest rate on credit card accounts with balances is about 15%. So you actually have a relatively good situation with those cards. And while it certainly is a drag to make those payments and be in front of you, I'd rather have you keep the cash handy for as long as you possibly can, because you may need that money for some other reason. And once you pay those credit cards off and tap all the money you've used for the student loan, it's very hard to go get it from someplace else. And, of course, you can charge the credit cards up if they're open and available to you, but that might not also be an option as well. Credit card companies can withdraw their credit basically whenever they feel like it. They can change the terms. Only if they raise the interest rates up, you know, for some reason into the 20s in terms of interest rate, then I would look at maybe cashing that proceeds out from the student loans and using it to pay it off. But otherwise, no. Keep that money aside. Make the payments as much as you possibly can, but keep the credit cards going. Don't worry about the interest, and don't worry about it when you do pay them off of that hurting your credit score that badly. It's better to have zero credit out and have it paid it off completely than have a higher balance out.
Thank you for the call, Con. Good luck to you. Heather in Clear Lake is with us now. Hello, Heather.
Hi. I am a new listener to public radio, and I've fallen in love with it, so thank you for all your wisdom.
You're very wise, Heather.
We love you, too.
I have kind of a silly question. I think it's, I think I know the answer, but I just want to hear it, from someone else. But, I used to work for a job for about 10 years that contributed to, Wisconsin retirement system. And so I have about $28,000 that I've put into retirement, into the system. And so, my employer also put that amount in. So if I take it out, I lose the amount that my employer put in. But I've recently fallen on some pretty hard times, and I'm only working part-time, and I'm also trying to start a business. And I had to sell my house on a short sale a couple years ago because of the situation. And so I don't have great credit. And my car, of course, is, you know, getting to the end of its life now, too. And and so I'm wondering if it's at all advisable to ever take out that retirement, or I realize I'd be losing a great amount, but I have like 25 years before I retire, and so it's really hard while I'm struggling day to day and week to week to have that money sitting there driving me kind of crazy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. How old are you, Heather?
I'm 35.
Okay. You've got 20 years until you can get the, and again, it depends on if you're 50 or 55, of what kind of employment category you are in the state, until that matching contribution there. So I would advise you to do everything you possibly can to avoid taking that money out. That said, it sounds like you said yourself, you've fallen on some hard times, and that money would be very valuable to you if you were to be able to get at it. Now, it is going to be taxable to you when you pull it out, but if you don't have a lot of income, that's not going to be a big deal. And you shouldn't starve just to preserve this notion that there's going to be this slightly higher dollar amount at some point in the future, which, quite frankly, it's maybe, as we mentioned earlier in the show, $28,000 is about what it costs for a person to live in Wisconsin for a year. So it's a year's worth of income. So if you said, hey, I'm going to take this money out now and I promise I'll retire 1 year later than I otherwise would, you'll probably work out even. So I'd prefer you leave it intact if you possibly can. But, you know, if you need a kidney, that's what you should do, is
right,
take that money out and spend it. If you have no other resources whatsoever at your disposal, just try it. And you sound like you've done a good job of this, but analyze how you got into this situation in the first place. And if it was just a mistake, people make mistakes, we all do, but try to avoid making the mistakes in the future. But if it was something due to just hard times and bad luck, the things over which you had no control, hey, you have to take it out, and you have to use it, and just do yourself a favor, and once you take it out, conserve it as best as you possibly can. Don't pay off all your debts right away. Just pay off everything month to month so that you can kind of keep some cash set aside there. And then also try to make a vow to yourself to say, you know what, I'm going to try to save a couple $1,000s a year for retirement once I get into a better shape. And if you do that, by the time you're 55, you'll have way more than if you were to have left the money intact and been stressed out by this. Because quite frankly, the stress that you're under over this is emotionally and, in my opinion, physically damaging.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Heather, good luck with your business venture. Please keep in touch. Let us know how things work out. Thank you for calling. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Here's an email from Sarah. She writes, my fiancé and I are getting married this August. Well, congratulations, Sarah. While wedding planning is going well so far, we have recently been thinking about buying a house before the wedding. This is due to some financial mistakes I made, as well as my student loans bringing up my debt-to-income ratio. I would not be approved for a mortgage. However, we are fortunate to have the finances needed for a down payment. Is it a good idea to try to get a home loan in his name only before we are married? How does this affect me in the future?
Well, first of all, mazel tov on the wedding. Mm-hmm. And second of all, as long as you are buying a house for the right reasons, and by right reasons meaning you feel like you're going to be in a specific area for several years, five or more, second of all, using up all of your savings for the down payment won't put a huge strain on you financially. Otherwise, trust me, you're going to have other strains after the wedding that will cause enough stress for you. You don't also need to be tapped out completely from your savings and have financial issues as well. If those two things are true, then I'm okay with proceeding to buy the house. If you're doing it because you say, gee, we need to hurry up and buy a house because prices are going up, or if you're doing it because say we need to buy it right now because my credit isn't good, once we're married, we're not going to have as good a credit together as he would on his own, then I would ease back on it a little bit, just because you may be buying houses, and especially if you're buying in certain areas, like Madison, for instance, you might be paying more now than you would be able to get for it if you were to sell the house in a few years. So I don't disavow the notion of going through with this, as long as you buying and owning a house already feels like the right thing to do. And if you are going to do it, I would definitely look to do it before you get married rather than after. But time does go by very quickly, and if you can get married and then keep paying your bills on time, you will find your credit score and your combined credit scores will elevate up to a level where it will not be a problem to buy a house in the future when you might have a better idea of what your future might be.
Thank you, Sarah, for the email, and best wishes on your wedding day. It is time now for Smart Assets. It's been a long time since most investors have experienced a big drop in their account values, so Kevin says it's a good time to run a stress test on your investments. Why do you say that, Kevin?
It's been over 6 years since the bottom in the stock market, if you will, for the United States stock market. Thanks to the seemingly endless pumping of money from the Federal Reserve and to a lesser extent, the improving economy, and many investors have become more confident, especially recently, and prices have risen very dramatically over that time. And more importantly, we haven't had a very big correction that can kind of scare people and give them a little perspective on their investments here. So if you're worried you're becoming a little too confident in your investments and how they've been doing, we give you a chance to give that self-imposed correction on your own money and see how you feel and test yourself.
So how do we go about testing ourselves?
Well, first, divide your assets into categories. These would be stocks and stock mutual funds, and then bond and bond income mutual funds, and then finally money market accounts and certificates of deposits and the savings bonds that Judy brought up recently.
All right, so I've got them all memorized. Now what?
Calculate what a big drop would do to the values and to your financial security and to your mental and emotional well-being. For stocks, if you got one stock, use 100% drop. It's very, very unlikely that a good company is going to go out of business, but it has happened in the past and it will happen in the future. If you have a diversified stock portfolio, put in a 75% drop and see how that looks. For stock funds, you might want to figure 50%, meaning if you have $50,000 right now in stock funds, think about what it would look like if they were to drop down to $25,000 over, let's say, a year's time or so. Bond and income funds, even safe ones, can drop as well, and I would use about a 30% drop to stress test those particular assets. And then finally, for money markets and CDs, it's 0%, which ironically enough is about what you're going to make on those accounts as well. Once you run through this little math exercise and see what it looks like when these accounts have been decimated to varying degrees, do these new values stress you out? And if they do, you may want to become more conservative than you currently are.
It worries me just to hear the word decimated. So who should be worried about a drop and who should be less worried?
You should be worried if you are going to need this money for a specific use. Let's say you're going to be buying a house or kids are going to college, and especially if it's nearing the goal of when you're going to need it, like you're coming up on retirement at 62 or 65 or something and you're only a couple years away. Or if you have more than enough money to pay for the goal already, why are you continuing to try to earn more by taking a chance that you could lose a lot of it right before you would need it? Those people who should be less worried are those who are a long ways away from needing it, meaning if you're 35 years old and you're going to retire at 65, you got 30 years to save and to handle any drops. In fact, you should be hoping for drops, because if you're contributing to the account, it allows you to buy more at lower prices, especially if you're still saving towards that goal and you won't need it. Then you shouldn't be quite as worried about these big drops, but you should be aware that they can and will happen in the future.
Yeah, but aren't those who invest more conservatively going to miss out on higher returns?
Yeah, they may. But that allows me to run through one of my favorite exercises, where you have two portfolio choices, two hypothetical portfolios. Portfolio A pays you 3% every single year for 5 years. And over the same 5-year time frame, portfolio B, your second option, will make 10% each year, except one of those 5 years. It will drop 20%, okay? So Portfolio A just pays you 3% every year for 5 years. Portfolio B makes 10% in 4 out of 5 years and then drops 20% in 1 of those 5 years. We just don't know which year that will be. Portfolio A, of course, the average annual rate of return over those 5 years will be 3%. Portfolio B, because of that big drop, will only average 3.2%. All right. Even though it made 10% in 4 out of 5 years, it lost 20% one of those years. Therefore, the average rate of return is about 3.2% per year. And you only get that if after a 20% drop happens, you are gutsy and brave enough to hang on to get the subsequent rise back up in the future years.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our next caller is Josh in Madison. Hi, Josh.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. Kevin, my question for you has to do with Roth versus traditional IRAs and 401ks.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a lot of unknowns in making the choice between a Roth and a traditional. There's unknowns about your expectations for your income in the future and your income during requirement, and as well as unknowns about tax law changes or potential tax law changes in the future. And I was wondering, what resources do you recommend I consult to try to reduce those unknowns and basically just make the most informed decision that I can?
Two words, crystal ball. Depending on your situation, Josh, usually as a rule of thumb, if you are in a lower income tax bracket now, or if you think you might need the money, which oftentimes coincide, you should use the Roth IRA because you don't get a tax break on that, but you're already in a low tax bracket because the tax break's not a very big deal. And if you need the money, you can pull contributions to a Roth IRA out whenever you want, at any time, for any reason, with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And then in retirement, the money is tax-free, and as of today, distributions do not affect the taxation of Social Security. And so, in effect, you can take $1 million out of an IRA, and that will not make it more likely that your Social Security in retirement is taxable. However, if you are in a high tax bracket right now and you don't think you'll need the money, then it's better off usually to make the tax-deductible contribution to either an IRA or a 401k, or both if you can afford to do it and you meet the qualifications. Because most people, Josh, are in a lower tax bracket in retirement for a couple of reasons, one of which is they don't need as much income because they don't have as many obligations and liabilities in retirement as they did while they were working, and also because they can manipulate their income. When you're working, you can't go to your boss and say, hey, I know you're going to pay me $50,000 a year, but I'd like to take nothing this year and $100,000 next year, just because I'll save money in taxes. What they'll do is they'll say, yeah, we'll give you your full year, and then we're going to fire you after that free year. But you can do that when you're retired. You can choose when to take money out and how much to take out at certain times in many cases. And by doing that, you can help lower your overall effective tax break. So high income, get the tax break now. Low income, use a Roth IRA now.
All right. Thank you very much.
So three words, Kevin, on your money.
Yes, just keep calling us every week. So still Roth IRA? Still think that? Okay, good.
Good luck, Josh. Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we will talk about the one thing you don't want to leave home without if you're going to hit the water this summer, and answers to more of your personal finance questions. We are having some hot fun on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. And when you load up to hit the water this summer, don't forget the most important item. And Kevin, what would that be?
Those would be life jackets or personal flotation devices, PFDs. You know, we've had a change in attitude over the past few decades on seatbelts. bike helmets, sunscreen, a lot of things that when you and I grew up, Joy, we would have, parents would have laughed at us if we said, hey, should we buckle up? They're like, no, because it's, you know, it's harder for me to slap you in the back seat if I'm belted in here. But now it's accepted, and I believe that we should and will adopt this attitude about flotation devices. There are about 10 drowning deaths per day in the United States, and in Wisconsin, according to the DNR here, we've already had three drowning deaths related to boating, and in all three of those cases so far this year, none of the victims were wearing life jackets. And in the words of a sheriff who was talking about having to rescue drowning victims or try to just get the bodies out, he said most of these drowning deaths are preventable. And according to the Center of Disease Control, about half of all boating deaths could be avoided if those people were wearing life preservers. It's one of the leading causes of death of children, and especially poorer children who don't have access to swimming lessons. So it's definitely something that I hope we can move forward on, making life jackets ubiquitous.
Yeah, very, very tragic story just over the weekend in Madison, where a young man jumped from a boat to take a dip to cool off, and
yep,
he didn't return.
That's
he did
terrible.
The surface. So what are the rules for using life preservers in Wisconsin?
Well, one word, good rule of thumb is always, but according to the law, you have to have at least one wearable life preserver for each person in the boat, and that does apply to kayaks and canoes and rafts and paddle boards. And if the boat is 16 feet or longer, you do also need to have a cushion or a throw ring on it as well. And the fine, if you don't have a life preserver on board and accessible for you, for every person on the craft, there is a $162 fine if you're caught for each instance.
How much do we pay for life jackets?
Yeah, they cost about $20 to $50, depending on if it's a kid's one or an adult one, or what do you have you. And for $100 or more, you can get those automatic inflatables one. But keep in mind that those are now machines, and they're required to work. And the only way you know you're going to work is if you fall in the water and they automatically inflate. If they don't, you might be in trouble. Sometimes they have a hand pump on them as well that you can inflate. But those are very comfortable to wear, and they're better than no life jacket at all, but they're not a panacea. You can still use a used life jacket, obviously, as long as it's in good working order, doesn't have any rips or tears or leaks, but you don't have to buy one. If you're at any place near water, chances are somebody has a life jacket. If you say, hey, could we just borrow this for a trip out on the boat, or my kids are going to jump in the water, could we use your life preservers? Most people would be happy to do that if they're not using it themselves. And the resort or the pool might have some that you could use as well. And there's a big campaign nationwide called Kids Don't Float, where they're trying to set up stations where people can use life preservers in all different sizes, from kids to adults, and then just return them afterwards. I think it's a great idea. It's hard to, you know, the logistics of it are difficult to accomplish, because obviously at every point of entering the water, there's not going to be able to be a station. But check around and see if Google Kids Don't Float for the particular area where you're going to be in the water, and see if they have one of those life jacket stations as well.
Oh, good idea. Any other guidelines for staying safe on the water?
Yep. Swimming pools are better than lakes, and lakes are much better than rivers, especially when it comes to kids.
Yeah.
You want to keep them out of moving water at all possible, and because, of course, the underlying shoreline and the riverbed can move a lot. Just because the river was safe to be in last year at this time or a week ago doesn't mean that it's still the same depth. Don't put the burden on the lifeguard. Just because the lifeguard is there doesn't mean the kids are necessarily going to be safe. Assume never that there's a person watching them unless it's you watching the kids. Even when the kids can swim, a lot of people say, okay, my kid can swim. They can swim out to the raft or whatever. Well, as we well know, it only takes a second of panic where you swallow some water, or the water goes into the lungs and goes into the murky water. It's very hard to find the kids. And if the kids are underwater for 3 or 4 minutes, it's very hard to save them lives. However, you may want to learn CPR if you don't know it, because if you can get a victim out of the water and they're still alive, CPR applied immediately can help save their lives. Parents, we can set very good examples by wearing vests and making the kids wear them too, just like we do with safe belts. Finally, four more words for this: don't drink near the water if you can help it, and definitely don't dive.
Yeah, that's good advice. You know, I can't wait to get to the beach this summer, but it'll have to wait until after I go to Alaska next week. I'm going to be going to Alaska and on a WPR trip.
Oh, and that sounds fantastic.
It's going to be great. It's going to be beautiful scenery, and I'm really looking forward to the trip. I'm also looking forward to a kayaking adventure I'm going to be taking, where we are promised, or at least told, we might see even whales while we're out in kayaks. So you can bet that I'll have a life jacket on.
Yeah, and bring your Zebco fishing rod in case you can land one of those, too.
I'll do that. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. And we have time now for more of your questions for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go next to Anne in Waukegan. Hi, Anne.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin, and thank you for this program. I'm going to be receiving July 1st a pension from my previous employer. I was vested in the company. So this is not a pension that I contributed to, and I'm very grateful for that. It's not going to be a huge amount. It's only a couple of $100 a month. But I would like to know the best place to put it. I do currently have a flexible premium deferred annuity, and I also have some stocks. But I was wondering, I would like to, I think, I'm not positive, but I think the best thing to do is have it direct deposited so that it does not come through my hands. And I'm wondering about putting it in a CD. What's your opinion?
Sure. Are you working right now, Ann?
No, I'm not. I'm 65 and retired.
Okay, good for you. The best thing to do with it is not put it in that flexible deferred annuity, nor is it a good idea to buy stocks. And for a couple of reasons, one of which is both of our longtime listeners know I'm not a huge fan of annuities in many cases. And with the stocks, if you buy stocks with $200 at a time, you're creating a nightmare if you ever have to sell those stocks because you have to figure those $200 purchases for cost basis, and it can really be difficult. So is there a reason you don't want it to come to you, or do you think you're just going to spend it, or is it just going to be easier if you have it direct deposited?
Both.
Okay, good for you. You're self-aware.
Because it's not a huge amount per month, it's easy to spend.
Yep. So what I would do is if you have some, a savings account, checking account or something, yes, I would have it directly deposited. That. You may want to put it in kind of a rainy day fund that's separate from the checking account you use to pay for groceries and utility bill, et cetera. And by having it set into that separate account, it's compartmentalized enough that you will be less tempted to get at it, but it's still accessible if you need it for an emergency or if you're going to take a trip. $2,400 a year can buy one person a decent trip, and if you save it for a couple of years, $5,000 could pay for most trips that one would want to take. And so I would definitely have that money set aside in a different account so that you don't use it, but don't worry about investing it. Just keep it safe and keep it liquid. And again, because it's not, you know, $2,000 a month, it's not like it's going to be a big difference to you if you don't make a ton of money on it, but I would use it for something above and beyond your normal expenses or an emergency.
Thank you, Ann, for the call. Kurt in Menominee is with us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey, as we were sitting around a campfire with some friends of ours whose kids are just graduated from college and mine are still in the throes of their post-secondary education, the question came up as one of the two friends is now bought a house, and they're saying, oh, you need to build your credit. So what's the best way for those in college to build their credit?
Yeah, it depends on the kid and the situation. If the kid has proof of income at any kind of job whatsoever, it might be a good time to open up their own credit card as long as you are watching it to make sure the kid doesn't use it irresponsibly and not pay it off and then damages their credit more than not having a credit card at all. An easier way to do that, and it's a little trickier though, is to become an authorized user on the parent's account, meaning that the kid can technically use the card if they want, and they will hopefully benefit from the parent's responsible use of the card, and it will go on their credit score as well. And a good exercise in this process, Kurt, is to actually go to a place like myfico.com, and if you pay about $20 per bureau, you can actually get the kid's current credit score. And not only that, but you can sit down with the kid and say, look at this little tool here. See what happens if you miss a payment. Watch how your credit score drops. Or if you charge too much on it over and above the acceptable limit, watch how your score drops. Or if you make your payments on time, watch how your score rises. And then they also will show you if with a specific credit score now versus what it might be in the future, for better or for worse, what interest rates will be, meaning that, you know, you might have to pay 6% for a car loan, whereas normally it would be 4% if your credit were good, and then how much that cost them in real dollars. So, yeah, I would have them get the card, but I would have you monitor it very closely just to make sure that the payments are made on it, at least the minimum payments are, and then they don't go crazy with it.
So are there any utilities like cell phone or other things like that could also help build the credit score?
Yeah, those help a little bit, not as much as actually borrowing money. What's interesting is the credit score actually affects those other things like auto insurance premiums, homeowners insurance premiums, and in some extent it's legal to separate job applicants based on their credit score, meaning that some companies won't hire people who don't have good credit for lots of different reasons. And that's unfortunate for the people with bad credit. It's good if you've got good credit, and it's one more reason to have the kids learn how to use credit responsibly and keep that score as high as possible.
Thanks for the call, Kurt, and good luck to your college student. I would have been in so much trouble, Kevin. I don't think credit cards were invented when I went to college.
No, you would go to the general store, and you would buy your flour and your hard tack, and they would have a little credit listing on there, and you'd either pay it off or you'd carry an account forward if you had to.
I would have been charging up those ramen noodles and such. Mike in Elkhorn is with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. My question is related to, and I love the program, by the way, but my question is related to highly compensated employees. Once HCE, you know, gets everything out to the 401k that you possibly can, which in my case is only 6%, and then you max out on your IRA, what is the vehicle that you're recommending to other HCEs to what to do with that extra money? I mean, you could use the, you know, in our plan, I mean, I could use a backdoor provision to go up to $53,000 going into that 401k, but I think for sure that will blow the non-discrimination testing, and I don't want to do that. So, I mean, what is the vehicle that you recommend to use?
There are a few more esoteric ways that what happens is for people who aren't familiar with this, the laws are set up so that that employers who offer retirement plans have to offer them to all their employees, and it can't be used for to a certain degree for people who make a lot more money than the average employee to sock away a lot more side. There's some kind of balancing and fairness testing. And for better or for worse, that means that people like Mike who are highly compensated employees, and there's a specific designation for that, that means that they can't save as much of their salary as their percentage than they possibly can. Yeah, you can do that backdoor route, but that can lead to other problems down the road. And you're looking to try to get a tax deduction to bring off more of your income, correct?
I would prefer to do it that way, but obviously, you know, I'm not as concerned about what my retirement income is going to be when I retire. I just wanted to, you know, I hate to see the cash go into something that, because honestly, I don't have the time to play the whole day trading stock market
good
thing. So my question is more, you know, does it make sense to put the money into, you know, index funds like a Vanguard fund or...
Yeah,
is there something else that I should be looking at?
No, if you don't need the money, Mike, that's definitely what I would look at, is save for it as you would in a normal retirement for it, but do it in something that's called and especially if you're comfortable with Vanguard, they have things, these things called tax-managed mutual funds, where you don't get a tax break when you put the money in, but they manage the distributions of capital gains and dividends in the future so that you don't incur a lot of taxation until you actually sell it and need the money. And in an ideal situation, how this would work is you would accumulate money in this and try to do it again by maybe one lump sum deposit each year, so you only have 1 year's worth of purchases to figure out if and when you go to sell it. And then you would hopefully defer a lot of the gains over time, and then when you retire, you're likely going to be in a lower income tax bracket. And when you sell this fund, if you need it to live off of or you want to do something different with it, if the laws are still the same, you'll be in a lower tax bracket, and you'll pay little or nothing in long-term capital gains that are inherent in the fund. So you don't get a tax break on any of the deposits, but you shouldn't have a lot of taxes while you're accumulating the money. And then if you play it right and the laws stay the same, you'll have very little taxes when you sell it in retirement.
And good luck to you, Mike. So time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Oh, well, we had mentioned comparing salaries and cost of living across the board. CNN has a fantastic, very easy-to-use cost of living for many cities. They even include, you know, Fond du Lac, Janesville, Eau Claire, and La Crosse, along with hundreds and hundreds of other cities and states across the country. And we'll put that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And Kevin and I will both be off next week. So John Munson will have another financial advisor answering your questions on the next On Your Money. But we will be back with another edition of All Questions Answered when we return. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.